So let's take a little bit of a look at the beginning of Parshas Noach. And there's a lot to say about Noach the Parsha, Noach the character, and Noach the first Aliyah. And I think what we'll do is let's talk broadly about some of what is conveyed in this first Aliyah. And then after that, we'll go back to looking pasuk by pasuk, you know, the time that we have. And the first pasuk really contains a lot of it. The fact that Noach has a very complicated reputation. It has very unusual PR, because here you have somebody who seems to be doing pretty well as far as his image is concerned. He has a parsha named after him, and it's not one of the bad namings like Balak or Korach, right? It's a good naming. It's the first parsha named after everyone, named after someone. He's a hero of the parsha. And the parsha has a lot of good things to say about him. He's tzaddik tamim, es elokim hisalech Noach. We're told before this that Noach matzachein. So if you read just the Torah Shebichsav, you would think that Noach's quite an impressive person, and that you would be quite thrilled to have the reputation, the PR, that Noach has. But amongst the rabbis, it's a very different image. And if you look at the Torah Shebaal Peh, so we find in the Midrashim and in the Gemaras in various places that they are much more down on Noach, or at least they're much more divided about Noach. That there's a lot that is said that is either disputed or overtly negative. And everything the Torah says is good, kamat, Chazal tell us, can be read in a possibly negative way. And maybe most well known is Rashi's comments, quoting from the Gemara, about Bedorosov, that Yesh Darshan L'Shvach, Yesh Darshan L'Gnai, that Bedorosov might be good, might be bad, might be good in the sense that even in such a evil generation, he was able to maintain his righteousness. Or maybe it's bad, maybe it's saying it's only relative, that compared to others in a different generation, he would not have stood out as a tzaddik. The Gemara that Rashi is coming from actually has it in harsher language, that had he lived in Avram's door, he wouldn't have been anything. It wouldn't be nechshav keklum. It's a pretty harsh language. Parenthetically, he did live in Avram's door, because he lived a long time, and he overlapped for 58 years with Noach. He lived 58 years with Avram. And it's interesting that he was so ineffective at that point that we could say as if he didn't live with Avram, but he did overlap with Avram. But okay, his time of activity was earlier.
Isn't that right?
Maybe. So that's something also to think about. We'll come back to that point.
Of course, he turned his daughter Flubba.
Yeah, it's a good question too. So we see that Noach's period of activity was really earlier, and in any event, it's a debate whether that was only relative glory or relative righteousness, or did he have objective righteousness that would have distinguished him even in other generations. And we find this throughout Chazal. We find that there are many downplayings or negative interpretations of the statements that the Torah has about him. Even the idea of Es Elokim Hisalech Noach, Noach walked with God. Maybe that's in contrast to others who were able to walk on their own. Noach needed help. There's a way of reading everything negatively, and for some reason Chazal had this perception of Noach, or at least some of Chazal had this perception of Noach, that he did not deserve such credit. And we don't see that in the Tarish Baal Peh, but in the Tarish B'Chzav. At the end of the parsha, things take a different turn, but at least as far as what is described here, we don't see this in the Torah Shebichsav, but maybe we do get a hint in it from the Haftorah. The Haftorah, maybe we spoke about this a little bit last year when we were going through the Haftorahs, but the Haftorah is from the Sefer Yeshaya, and there, maybe there's a clue that Noah had something to be criticized about him. Why? Because the connection to the Haftorah And this is not the only parsha that has this Haftorah, by the way. This Haftorah is broken up into parts and used for other parshias as well. It's actually part of the Shiva de Nechemta. But here, the reference, just to open up the Haftorah, the reference to Noach is, to find the pasuk here, this Chumash the Psukim are numbered, so it's not even going to help you when I find it. But just to read you the language, Kimei Noach Zosli, Asher Nishbaiti, Me'avor Me'Noach, Oral Aris, Kenishbati, Mitzayf Alayich, Migarbach. So here, the time of the flood is referred to as Me'Noach, or the waters of Noach. So that's a little strange, because Noach was the one person who didn't drown in the waters, Noach and his family. So maybe we should have said, Kimei, everyone but Noach. Why should it be named after Noach? So there are those who understand that this is to indicate that Noach bore some responsibility for the flood. Now, the Radak points out that there are possibly two ways to read this word, as one word or as two words. It could be Kimei Noach Zosli, or there's one word, Kimei Noach, like the days of Noach, which would be a little bit less negative. But it comes up again in the end of the Pasuk, where it's by itself as Mei Noach. So one way or another, the flood seems to be associated with Noach, the one person, the one family that survived it. So this seems to reflect an attitude that we find again in Chazal repeatedly, that Noach bore some responsibility because he did not change the people. He did not do what he needed to do to try to influence them and to try to reverse the course. And in that sense, he is contrasted negatively with other biblical figures, notably Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu. That there's parallels there where each of those are increasingly more impressive. Because Noach is told the world is going to be destroyed, and he acts on instruction to save himself, but not anybody else. He doesn't daven on their behalf, as far as we're told. He doesn't try to convince the people that the end is nigh, and you have to do something to change your behavior. He doesn't address the fate of everyone else at all. Chazal do tell us that he built the ark publicly, and when people would come and ask him what's going on, so then he would explain and use that as a possible mussar opportunity. But there again, we find different interpretations. Does that mean that's the only thing he did, and that it was only because he was put in this position to do it publicly, so then, okay, he ended up talking to people? Or was that more proactive? Multiple interpretations continue in just about every step. But it seems like he was deficient compared to Avram and Moshe. I'll take a question in a second, just to explain the Avram Moshe point. So Avram, we know, is told that Sodom was going to be destroyed. So his family, Lot, are going to be saved. Avram doesn't say, okay, it's a good thing my nephew's going to be okay. But instead, he davens on behalf of the people of Sodom. So he goes a step further than Noach, a significant step further than Noach was willing to go. And Moshe Rabbeinu is even beyond that, because when it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's told that after the Chet Ha'egel, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'll get rid of them and I'll make you into a new nation. So not only does Moshe daven on their behalf, but he says, if that's not going to work out, then mechein yinam misefrucha, then erase me from your sefer, that I don't even want to be included here. And the Arizal had a fascinating ha'ara, that the letters of Mecheni are the same letters of Menoach, switched around, as if to suggest that Moshe's behavior was a tikkun for what Noach didn't do. And that's the criticism here, that Noach was responsible on some level, and Moshe Rabbeinu represents a very different kind of behavior. It's striking. This is a very extreme example of survivor guilt. Sometimes when others die and somebody survives, he feels a sense of guilt as to why he's the one to survive. Here, this is a unique application of that. We're saying that not only does Noah get to survive when everyone else dies, but he bears some liability, or at least the negligence of the neglect of what he could have done to make a difference. So it's literal survivor guilt, that the survivor has some guilt for the loss of others, a powerful idea. So anyway, there were a few hands up. So who was up first? God. Yes, sir.
Kill us,
me. I don't know. Okay, he's willing to daven on your behalf. Yeah?
At least in the prism of keeping on Bereshis, we're only comparing him to Abraham and Moshe. What about Yitzchak and Yaakov? Do we have an instance of them being misvalid for other people?
Well, they don't have the same. We do in Chazal. But there's what to quote about that, but that'll take us far afield. But I don't know if it matters. We don't necessarily have the same kind of challenge. You know, here, in the case of Avram and Moshe, we have explicit incidents where they're told, okay, there's a group of people that are going to be wiped out, and you'll be spared. So you have that kind of a parallel, that three times someone is told, you'll be okay, but others won't. Noach says, cool, all right, I'll do that. I'm not to diminish it, but Noah says, okay, fine, I'll save myself. And Avram says, no, wait, save them too. And Moshe says, save them, and if not, I don't want to be a part of it. So it's a direct parallel with increasing self-sacrifice. Sam?
Yeah, just on the point of Noah now arguing, I guess, trying to change the outcome, of Hashem's decision, why is that, like, such a bad thing necessarily, because if Hashem makes a decree, then
so you're asking a very interesting question with many different implications, because it could be asked even more forcefully about Avraham Avinu, right, where Avraham Avinu not only davened but argued and implied that there was a lack of justice in the decision. So that's a discussion worth having, but that's a broader point. But here we also find a mixture of criticisms. Is it just that he didn't daven? Or maybe he should have done something to make a difference. Maybe he should have tried to influence the people. And you also, again, find different languages in Chazal. Some places it sounds like lo haya yachol, like he didn't have the ability to affect anybody. And that's an interesting question, how to interpret that. Is that basically saying that he never bothered to establish the relationships that would have made a difference, or maybe he was afraid to establish the relationships that would have made a difference, but now, at the moment of crisis, he's not able to have an impact on anyone because of what he didn't do earlier. So there are various ways of framing it, but there's this overwhelming negativity that emerges against Noach and his apparent inadequate response, despite the fact that the language of the Torah Shebichsav seems so glowing and so positive. Gilad?
No, that's very similar.
Okay. So, you know, perhaps we can identify what's going on here by focusing on one specific midah. And it's interesting that one more comment that seems to go against Noach after it sounded good, is we're told in the end of Bereishis that Noach Motzachin. Right, that sounds like a great thing. Noach won over a favor in God's eyes. So that's something we would all like to have said about us. And yet, here again, Chazal say, oh, you see, you see how undeserving he was? That really, he was not right to be saved. But Motzachin, he found favor in God's eyes, so he was able to get out, even though he didn't really deserve it. So how did he find favor in God's eyes? What was special about him? So there are a number of suggestions in the Mefarshim, and some have the idea that Noach was very far from the Midah of Kas. And that was what was significant about him. There are other suggestions also, Chazal Telech Noach learned Torah, other things. But the fact that he was very calm, and in fact, that's what his name means, right? To be calm, Noach conveys that attribute. So the fact that he was very slow to anger and in control of his emotions is something that earned him this chen. So,
you could darshan, we say that we understand Kaspi of Vodazara, and it's a door that's also Osik and Vodazara as well as Kaniva and
mm-hmm.
So maybe if Noach is refraining from the, if he's the only person that's staying away from Das, from Kas, if he's the only person staying away from the Vodazara.
Because Kas is equated to Vodazara.
Right.
So let's talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about that idea. But before getting into that, so Kas is a complicated concept. Because from a perspective of the Midah of anger, so we find that there's a little bit of a mixed attitude. That on the one hand, the Midah of anger is something that we're told to stay very far away from. And the Gemara suggests that it's even an Avera. There's an Avera of Kas. And the Rambam, when he talks about Midos, so the Rambam says Midos in general, one should strive for a middle path. But there are two exceptions, Kas and Gaiva. When it comes to Kas, you shouldn't be involved at all. On the other hand, there is a drawback in not feeling any Kas. Because there are times when you have to speak up. There are times when you have to get angry. There are times when there's injustice and wrongdoing in the world. And to not react at all, to just say, okay, whatever. I don't think we would be too impressed with that. So it seems like on some level, there is a middle path that we're looking for. But perhaps to reconcile it with the Rambam, where it says there's no middle path, it's not in terms of moderation like we normally talk about, but it has to do with the stage of anger and what we mean by anger. And the Gemara gives us a little bit of insight into this. The Gemara in Maseches Tainis and Dav Dalet, the Gemara says that Hay Tamar Chacham derasach araisahu dekarascha. If a Tamar Chacham gets angry, it's the Torah that's making him angry. And then the Gemara says, even so, Iboile lemelef nafshe benachas, that he should still train himself to calm down. So what does that mean, that it's the Torah that's making him angry? He stayed up all night learning, so now he's grumpy. So Rashi explains, that could be true also, but Rashi explains that the learning gives him a certain Ruch of Hadas, a certain breadth of sensitivity and attention, makes them aware of more things. And the more you're aware of, the more it can upset you. If you're not aware of anything, so there's nothing that's going
Ignorance is bliss,
right? And ignorance is calmness. If you don't know about anything, so nothing's going to get you worked up. But if you have a broad sensitivity, so then you're more susceptible to being riled up in anger. But nonetheless, how you respond to that initial instinct is still important. You have to still control yourself. And in the poskim, in the Sifrei Musar, many of them point out that a display of anger has a role sometimes in terms of fighting injustice or simply educating your children. But it should only be a display. It shouldn't be actual loss of control. It shouldn't be actual loss of temper. So that idea of finding a middle path here is not about moderation per se in the usual sense. It's about where you stop yourself. And finding that kind of balance, perhaps we also have, once again, within Noach, another clue from another negative statement, yet again, that Chazal have to say about the poor guy. Maybe that can give us a little bit of insight into how you find this balance. That poor Noah, after being chosen as the one guy to survive and to spend all this time following God's command and building the Teva, after all that, so Chazal call him lacking in faith. And Rashi quotes the idea that Af Noach miktani amuna, that even Noach was not so terrific in Emuna, poor guy. And the Medrash language is stronger, maybe Michusari Emuna. And the prompt to say that from the text is that it sounds like from the Torah that Noach only got into the Teva when it really started coming down. So why did he wait? If God told him what's going to happen, he should ready to get on board. So whether that's the only reflection of it, or that seems to be used to make this point that Noah was lacking in faith. Hi.
I'm just really confused, because wasn't another Kisar they said to Noah was that he just accepted it was going to happen and didn't try to, like, stop it from happening?
Yeah, well, there's definitely some mixed confusion.
So
is
you can't
well,
hack him on, like,
right, the confusion is well-founded. He's definitely getting hit from every direction here.
Mm-hmm.
But that point you could probably reconcile. It's, yes, he accepts it's going to happen, so we're not criticizing him for accepting that it was going to happen. It was the basis of why it happened, that the people were all guilty, or the lack of attempt to try to reverse the decision through tefillah. That's where the criticism. But the fact that he believed God, that was for sure appropriate. But here, they're criticizing him for not believing enough that he didn't get on board before that. So there's a lot of commentary and suggestion as to what exactly that means. And the Stipler writes that it means he knew it intellectually, but he didn't know it emotionally. He understood that it was coming, but he had to actually see it before he responded to it. But more broadly speaking, the idea of emunah has some relevance to finding this balance in terms of kas. Because one way to look at the emunah issue is to say that, and this is the way Reb Levi Yitzchak or Berdichev understood it, that the lack of emunah was a lack of emunah in himself. That he didn't believe that he could make a difference. Or some suggest he didn't believe that he could maintain his own tzidkus if he had been too involved with these negative role models. One way or another, he didn't have enough confidence in himself. He didn't believe in himself. Rabbi Simon has an essay about this in Imre Baruch, about this point from the Berdichever and others, that one has to have confidence in his own ability to make a difference. And up to Rebbe, the Ovi Yisrael, and others suggest that when Chazal tell us about Bedorosov, Yesh Darshan L'Shvach, Yesh Darshan L'Gnai, some see it positively, some see it negatively, the Yesh Darshan L'Gnai, that's Moshe, that's Noach himself. That Noach was Darish Lignai, that he didn't think that he was very worthy, he didn't think he had any kolchos, so he didn't have faith in himself. So one weakness on the anger spectrum, the part where you don't respond the way you should, and the appropriate amount of anger, is because you don't feel like you're irrelevant. You don't feel like you have any ability to make any impact. But on the other hand, so the other extreme, one loses his temper. So as Maury alluded to before, losing your temper is compared to idolatry. The Gemara Masech HaShabbos says that kol ha shover kelim b'chamoso is kilu avod avodah zarah. And the Rambam says even more broadly, kol ha kois kilu avod avodah zarah. And the idea, perhaps, of comparing it to avodah zarah, some say it's because you lose control and you subject yourself to an alien force like idolatry. But maybe we could also suggest that when you lose your temper and you just give up and you just explode in frustration, it's a lack of belief in a God who's running the world and who ultimately is in control of things. So essentially hitting this proper balance in terms of kas, where you're properly responsive to injustice, but you don't lose it. You don't completely give yourself over to anger. Requires a balance between these two types of emunah. Emunah in yourself, that you can make a difference, and emunah in the Ribbono Shel Olam, that ultimately it's not your job to make a difference by yourself. That you are not solely responsible for making everything fit. In the sense of what the Mishnah tells us, that lo alecha hamlocha ligmor, but at the same time, lo atab ben chayrin libatal mimena, that you can do your part and you must do your part and recognize ultimately that the Ribbono Shel Olam is running the show. So perhaps that's what is being conveyed here as far as this chisaron in Noach, that had he properly appreciated what he could do, so then he would have been closer to the balance, where he was on one extreme, the too calm extreme, he would have been closer to the balance of being able to make a difference. And to Meir Shapiro, Daf Yomi seen coming up. So it's interesting. I only know a few Divrei Torah from Rabbi Meir Shapiro, but you could find a common thread in all of them, and it all has to do with the fact that he made a difference. You know, he saw a world where he could make an impact, and Klal Yisrael will celebrate that in 2 months as yet another Siyum HaShas. So Rabbi Meir Shapiro suggested that the rainbow in the parasha was almost a shmuz to Noach, and possibly a few other Moser Shmuz. Some sources indicate that when God says to Noach, I have seen you to be a tzaddik, he was saying, no, you might be a pretty influential person if you try to use some of that stature. And Noach doesn't take the hint. So essentially, the rainbow is also a Moser Shmuz. And is saying that if after such a storm and such a rain, you can have this beautiful multicolored display, so you could also have made something glorious out of all of these people and all their stormy attitudes. And look what was lost here. Look what kind of opportunity was lost. But now is a new stage, and there's a shvua, and the Haftorah contains a reference to perhaps the second shvua, but that we don't need to go that path anymore, because on the horizon after Noach is an Avraham Avinu. So there will be a leader who will be able to bring about the Jewish people and will convey an attitude not only of personal righteousness, but also of seeking to be a beacon to the world. And even though Noach didn't fully grasp what he could have done, but there's hope for the future. And that's the message that the parsha ultimately brings us to, together with the Haftorah. So, with that framework, maybe let's look in the next few minutes that we have, just try to look at this psukim specifically. Hi?
Maybe the statement that Noach was Mekat Ne'emuna. I forgot what I was
going to
say.
Okay, see, you don't have to have more emuna in yourself to remember. Yes, see, it worked. Yes.
We have this understanding that Avraham is the first monotheist.
Yeah, well, so he had to rediscover monotheism, because if Noach is talking to God and the other Mary is talking...
If you understand Noach as being Mekat Ne'emuna, that he didn't really have a full Emuna.
But that doesn't mean he wasn't a monotheist. You know? It means that
right, and then Avraham was the first monotheist.
You mean you're saying that part of being a monotheist, right, you know, so clearly we have...
Is that a statement turning to Chazal, that Avraham was the first... That Avram was the first to.
No, but that Avram discovered it on his own and then preached to the world. Okay, so let's try to look at with this framework, we'll have some more references to this, but let's just spend a few minutes looking at the psukim in this first Aliyah. So first of all, the first word, Eila, told us Noach, so that also gets into the discussion here, because Chazal tells us generally that Eila comes to disqualify what was before. So here, Noach is also being praised, that until now, things weren't so great. But Noach, he was a person of stature. And indeed, he's called Ish Tzadik Tamim. So, Tzadik Tamim Hay Bedarosav. So, it's a discussion whether those are two different things, Tzadik and Tamim, or a perfect Tzadik. And the commentaries have different discussions, different perspectives as to what is being conveyed by the two terms. Some say, is it Tzadik in his actions? And a tamim in his attitudes, a tamim in his deos. Others understand tamim to mean that he was good both in ben adam l'makom and in ben adam l'chavero. So you have different understandings of what tamim could come to convey. But when God talks to Noach directly, he calls him a tzaddik, doesn't call him a tamim. So that the Gemara Maseches Erevin and Daf Yuches and Beis tells us that this is an example of the idea of mitzas shvacho lefanav. That when you praise someone, so when you're talking to them directly, you shouldn't say everything. You should hold back something. So the Torah Tamim has a comment here. It's interesting. It says, what's the reason for that? It says, the reason is nira kamachnef. Is that it looks like you're trying to flatter the person. Even though you have to say the emphasis on the nira, because Machnif we usually associate with insincere flattery, but the point is here, apparently there's true stuff that you're leaving out. So otherwise it wouldn't be mikzav shvacho. So, okay, you look like a machnif if you say everything that you could be saying about the person. So the Torah Tamimah discusses that, okay, but the idea of chanifa is that you need something from that person, so you try to butter them up. So that wouldn't apply to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, who doesn't need anything from anybody. But then he goes on to suggest, to parallel what we discussed last week about Nas Adam B'Tzalmeinu, that God is teaching us midos. So therefore, he shows us a certain kind of behavior, even if it isn't necessarily relevant to him. So then, after that, after we have Tzadik Tamim, so then we have that word Bidorosav. And as we've seen, Bidorosav is subject to multiple interpretations. So does that mean that he was good even in such a bad generation, or he only looked good because of that bad generation, but otherwise he would not have been so impressive? So it's still a very fascinating discussion in the Sefer Lev Avram, von Weinfeld. So he discusses, he says, this is, I'll be derech hatzach, it's not 100% serious. He says, but when we say Brich Shmei for Kriyas HaTorah, so we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for certain things. We say Zasarech HaMtivusa, that we ask him to extend our lives, and that we should be Pekidah V'God Tzadikaya, that we should be counted among the Tzadikim. So he asks the Lev Avram, says, why, first of all, are we asking for those two things next to each other, that we should have a long life, and that we should be counted among the tzaddikim? And also, what does it mean to be counted among the tzaddikim? So, mimanav shach, if we're tzaddikim, so then that's what's important. If we're not tzaddikim, then why are we asking to be counted among the tzaddikim? So, he suggests as follows. He says that there is relative glory. You can judge someone objectively, you could judge someone in comparison to others. And the world as a whole, every new generation is more impressive than the previous generation because they've accomplished more and they're more cultured and more technologically advanced. So every generation is embarrassed by the next generation because the next generation is so much more advanced than they are. But when it comes to Torah, so we look at it the other way around, that the earlier generations are closer to Sinai. And we have this concept of niskat nu hadoros on some level, that we're not on the level of the earlier generations. So we are embarrassed not by the next generation, but by the previous generation. So based on that, he writes, that somebody who's very elderly and is mixing with people who are younger, so he's going to look good by definition because he's from the earlier generation when things were closer to Sinai. And relative to the younger people he's with, he looks better than them. So he says, that's why we ask for these two things together. So we ask for a long life. And if we have a long life, then we will be counted among the tzaddikim. We will look, by comparison, better than the younger people around us because we are associated with the earlier, holier generation. So in that context, he says, here, when this story is happening, Noach still has a long time to live, as we said, but he's still quite elderly at this point. He's very, very old. He's many hundreds of years old. So Noach was really from an earlier generation. So he made the people around him look worse by comparison just for that reason, because he was from the earlier generation. So maybe you might think it's only because of that. It's only because he happened to have come from that earlier time. So then that's why he looked good relative to the people around him, but he didn't have objective merits. So he goes on to say, that's what it says Bedorosov, that even in his heyday, even when he was younger, even when he was with people of his own age group, he was also a tzaddik. And you shouldn't think that it's only because he's from the earlier generation. That's why he looks relatively impressive. So we have to thank the Lev Avram for putting one back in Noach's column and adding one interpretation that gives them a positive spin compared to everything else. But, like we said, things get worse once we keep going on. So Esalakim Esalach Noach. So that should sound like it's a good thing that Noach walked with God. We already mentioned the possibility that it's to imply that he was incapable of walking on his own 2 feet. But here also the Alshech has another negative interpretation, meaning that Esalakim, maybe he was only good at Ben Adam L'Makom. So he was good at walking with God, but he wasn't good at dealing with people, and that's why he wasn't able to make a difference. Okay, so sorry about that, Noach. But we're told, Vayolad Noach Shlosh Avonim, Hashem Eschav Yisrafes. So there's a whole discussion in the Rishonim how exactly to read these psukim, because Toldos in the previous pasuk, Toldos usually means the generations and the descendants, you'd expect them to be listed right away. Maybe here it means something else. Maybe here it means the story of Noach. So in any event, his family is mentioned in the next pasuk. And then we're told, V'tishvachei sa'aretz lefnei ha'elokim, v'atimalei ha'aretz chamas. Chamas is so overtly evil to even pick this name. So here, this idea that the land was filled with chamas, so Chazal have a tradition that lo nechtam zaydinam el gezel, that even though they did many bad things, but their fate was sealed because of gezel. And here, the usage of chamas, as opposed to a more direct word, so Chazal suggests, it's a good question how the word is used in general, that it's a type of financial corruption that's kind of just under the radar. And that basically they knew how to evade justice. They knew how to steal in a way they couldn't be prosecuted. So they would steal less than a shava pruta. And there's a whole discussion in general. What's the story with that? That normally when it comes to a shava pruta and stealing, so if you steal something, you have to return it. But if the item that you stole is less than a shava pruta, so then you don't have to return that item, because the assumption is that the victim was mechel, that he's not going to require to have his property returned if it's so inexpensive, if it's so worthless. So Magid Mishnah comments on the Rambam. The Rambam makes it clear in the beginning of Hilchos Gzeil, in the beginning of Hilchos Gneva V'Aveda, in Gneva and Gzeil V'Aveda, he makes it clear that there's an iser to steal anything. And it's just in terms of the chi of hashava, then we say that only applies a shuva pruta and up. And the Magid Mishnah says that this is an example of the concept of chatzi shir, and there's a whole discussion whether this is an appropriate application of the concept of chatzi shir. But as we've, I think, discussed not so long ago, that the concept of chatzi shir has a technical connotation, but it also, I think, has a broader connotation, that it's a way of saying that you have the essence of the Avera here, even if you don't have the technical requirements to be liable for it. And that's certainly what's going on here, that they found a way to commit the essence of theft by taking other people's property in a greedy, unjustified fashion, even though they weren't necessarily going through the technical process that would have gotten them in a position to be prosecuted for it. So that is a particularly dangerous kind of attitude. Corruption in a way that doesn't overtly place you in the context of the punitive code is perhaps even more dangerous than the more explicit identifiable kinds of corruption. And that's one element of why this was so bad. But also, just as far as Gezel being the focus, when there were other Averis going on as well, so the Ramban says that it's because it's Sichlius, it's Nimusus, it's something that is a part of general world culture and something we can figure out on our own. So therefore, that's really bad. You know, that if they were violating Averos that need to be explained to them or need to be conveyed to them, and there was some argument that they didn't understand, they didn't accept the instruction, so then maybe they could have survived that. But here, this is undeniable in its nature, and it's something the whole world can figure out as a problem, and you don't need any sources for it. So it's davka that sealed their faith. One could suggest we find that, I just think when it comes to talking in shul, so you find some very harsh statements about the aveiro of talking in shul and talking during davening, and about the consequences. Don't even want to repeat them, about the consequences that the rabbinic literature says associated with talking in shul. And sometimes they think it's because it's so intuitive. Like, you don't need any sources to explain that it's aveiro ben adam l'makom and ben adam l'chaveiro when you're talking at that stage. So then maybe the consequences are greatest when you're dealing with something like that. It doesn't need to be explained to anyone. But the Meshech Chachma has a interesting observation here. He says that if you want to draw a distinction between kol chukim and mishpatim, or sometimes called mitzvos sichlios, mishpatim, things that we can intellectually understand, and mitzvos shimios, the mitzvos that we observe because they're instructed to us. So normally, if you're dealing with a yachid, so we find there's more likely to be a punishment for a chok than there is for a mishpat. That the chukim have clearly delineated rules and consequences, and the mishpatim tend to have a more complex structure to them, and usually they're not subject to an onesh in the absolute sense. But when you're dealing with a societal perspective, so then if the society as a whole, if they have weaknesses in ritual, if they have weaknesses in ben adam l'makom, so God is able to tolerate it, so to speak. He is erech apayim as far as that's concerned. But when it's a matter of mishpat that the whole society is lacking in, so then that tends to be a quicker punishment. That tends to be something that is more likely to get them in trouble. So that's what the Meshech Chachma is suggesting, that is a flip. When you're dealing with individuals, when you're dealing with society, the impact is different. And the Torah Tamimo also adds that the Gezel was the last straw because it interfered with the ability to have a peaceful society. You couldn't have shalom. You couldn't have any ability to get along if that's what was going on, and therefore they end up being destroyed. It's fascinating. Some of the Mefarshim point out the whole discussion we could have, which is really a much longer discussion about, say, values of capitalism and communism and the struggle between the two philosophies. And the Torah is presumably somewhere in the middle. There's a lot to say about that, but Rabbi Yitzchak Blau wrote a very useful article about this topic in Tradition many years ago. And there he talks about attitudes of the rabbinic leaders to communism as a whole. And one of the points he quotes there is that in Parshas Noach, and next week's Parsha also, and Vayera also, so you see there's like a pendulum swinging between extremes, very negative versions both of capitalism and communism. So at the beginning of the Parsha, the Chet of the Dor HaMabul, the issue is extreme materialism. And essentially, it's a nightmare version of capitalism, exploitation of others. No.
Between,
is that what I said? Between the beginning of the parsha and the parsha, between the Mabul and the Dor HaFlaga. So here you find the beginning of the parsha. So the issue is essentially rampant materialism and exploitation, everything that's invoked negatively about capitalism. And the end of the parsha seems to be a description of a communist socialist society where everyone gets together and seeks to do a joint project to challenge God, all the implications of that, and Midrashim point to the de-emphasis of the individual in that context. So it sounds like the pendulum is swinging from the negatives of capitalism to the negatives of communism over the course of the parsha. And then after that, you get to Stone. Stone, the pendulum has swung back to another negative picture of capitalism, the idea of Shali, Shali, Vishalcha, Shalcha. The Mishnah in Avo says that, according to one opinion, the Mishnah is Midah Stone. That is not necessarily about stealing, but it's about the very rigid definition of, okay, I have what's mine, and you can't touch it at all. So without any chesed tempering it, not being modified by any concern for anyone else. So that's the pendulum swinging to another negative vision of a capitalist society. So we ultimately find ourselves in the middle, really, in a capitalist framework, but one that has strong chesed imperatives to make sure that everyone is taken care of within that framework. It's a much longer discussion, but it connects here to the beginning of Noach as well, so it's important to point that out. So we're almost out of time, so just to make a few other quick points. So here the pasuk says, so what's the reference to Al Haaretz here? There's different interpretations in the Rishonim. The Ksav HaKabbalah says it means Vipnei Haaretz, that because of the overflow of Gashmius that they had, of blessing that they had, so that led them astray, and that was the problem. Okay, so then we have the God tells Noach that it's over for the world, I'm going to destroy everyone. And the Selecha Tevas Atzik Ofer should build an ark, and then we have all the destructions of the ark, and the instructions of the ark, told that there's a Tzohar. So what is a Tzohar? So a Tzohar, there's a Chashuv, a rabbinic journal called Tzohar. So what is it meant to convey there? That there is a light. So he had lighting in the ark, but Rashi quotes two opinions of what that means. Does that mean that he made a window so they could see in? Or did they have a precious stone that glowed so they were able to see because of that? So the Torah Tumimah discusses that maybe this connects to the question of his level of righteousness. Is it just that he was saved and he was separated from it so he couldn't see what was going on? Or is he at such a level that he is Zeichel Liros Mapolten Shel Vashayim, that he saw the downfall of others, and that would be conveyed by the downfall of the wicked specifically, that would be what would be conveyed by the window idea. Okay, so we'll just skip to the end in the interest of time. But we'll end on one more ambiguous note, just to have the Chesima Me'ena Psicha, to see once again how this is a constant theme here. So Noach's given all these instructions, he's told to gather the food. Some of the Mefarshim point out that he must have had a sense of how long he was going to be in there, otherwise how would he know how much food to bring with all the animals? But okay, so then the Aliyah ends, Vayas Noach kechol asher tzivo so Elokim kein asah. How does that sound? Good or bad? He did everything God said. So for most people, that would be pretty good. For Aaron HaKohen, that was a good thing to say. But, of course, for Noach, it's ambiguous. So on the surface, it should be a good thing. Let's say for Ma'is HaShem, he adds that even more than you might realize, because it's to emphasize after this whole instruction of the food, that Noach had such emuna that had God said, get on the teva, without any food, he would have assumed, okay, I'll do that and I'll be taken care of. He wouldn't have thought, okay, I better just grab some snacks and some provisions to make sure that we can survive. So it's only because God told him to bring food that he brought the food. That was an expression of his emunah. But in the Tzor HaMor, he says, no, that the point is that he didn't pick up the message that he was supposed to do more than what he was told to do. That he cannot win. It just keeps coming at him. And at the point is, okay, so he was told to build the ark. He did exactly that. He didn't do any more. He didn't understand that he was supposed to impact people as well. So we can also maybe take the balanced message from Noach and take all the points here and understand that Noach certainly accomplished something, and that we should recognize the importance of being able to do that and being able to maintain our own personal integrity and righteousness in whatever environment we find ourselves. But to recognize that we also have a broader obligation within that, and that the message of Avraham Avinu is really the one that we look forward to. And Noach is a stage. He deserves credit. It's a madrega. But as much as we admire that madrega and learn from it, we also aspire to a greater madrega, and that awaits us in the parshias to come. So I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Again, Sunday, we'll probably meet around 10:30, and we'll start Chazara then with Munchim, and should be only good things. Okay, we'll see you soon.